if you continue down this road, the economic costs will be very significant.
Consequences of the U.S.-China trade war could be bad. It's Wednesday, October 10th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. You'll find us also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, Hong Kong's free speech questioned, tracking China's investment in Australia, the top cheeses in economics, ice on the moon, and Indian prisoners brewing coffee. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The International Monetary Fund says the escalating U.S.-China trade war will inhibit global economic growth this year and next, even as U.S. President Donald Trump again has threatened to impose higher tariffs on Chinese exports sent to the United States. In a new assessment issued at its meeting in Bali, Indonesia, the IMF predicted that everyone is going to suffer as the United States and China, the world's two biggest economies, spar over tariffs and other trade issues. It said the dispute between the United States and China would especially leave developing economies vulnerable to sudden stresses. VOA Asia's Ira Melman set out to get an explanation of what the IMF predictions mean. He found international economist Jacob Kierkegaard, senior fellow at the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Well, fundamentally, what the IMF is saying is that the accelerating trade war between the United States and China is going to have two major effects. First of all, it's of course going to make goods traveling between the two countries are more expensive. That means that consumers have less money to spend on other things, and everything else being equal is generally speaking bad for economic growth. It also leads to higher inflation and may therefore lead to higher interest rates. So that is the first negative impact of this. But then secondly, and perhaps more importantly, the IMF points out that this trade war, which is unfolding between the two largest economies in the world, are essentially undermining the general faith in the, shall we say, traditional rules-based international trading system. That basically the view here is that the United States is essentially acting outside the existing WTO rules. And this matters a lot for firms and businesses around the world who, when they make investment decisions, because when they make investment decisions around the world, and you know, these are investments that are, you know, projected to perhaps make a profit over the next 20 to 30 years, it matters a lot whether or not you actually have faith in the fact that the trading system, as we know it or have come to know it in the last 20 years or so, remains. And ultimately, what the IMF is pointing out is that there are increasing concerns among investors about this, and therefore they're likely to make less investments in new plants, new equipment, new machines. There'll be less hiring, not just in the United States and China, where although those that will be where most of the negative effect will be, but also in other countries that trade with the United States and China. And therefore, this is really altogether bad news.
What does nationalism do on the sides of both the United States and China when it comes to trying to come to some agreement or reach some kind of accord on trade?
Undoubtedly, the nationalism on both sides makes it more difficult for leaders to strike a deal because you have nationalists in the United States and in China who will view any concessions given by either President Trump or President Xi as essentially surrender, as an unacceptable loss of face.
Does this latest IMF report illuminate any light at the end of the tunnel for this?
In short, no. I mean, what the IMF report does is that it highlights that for the United States and China, the cost of continuing the trade war are very significant. So basically what the report does is they point out to leaders in both countries that if you continue down this road, the economic costs will be very significant. But it doesn't necessarily offer any immediate sort of solutions to these disputes, although implicitly one would have to say that the report makes it clear that a return to the status quo ante, meaning before Donald Trump started to levy tariffs on steel and washing machines and a whole bunch of things after he came into office, would implicitly result in a significant upgrade in growth. But as I said, ultimately the report doesn't offer any solutions, merely pointing out the costs of continuing down the current path.
The United States and China have imposed higher tariffs on tens of billions of dollars worth of products the two countries have exported to each other, with no immediate end in sight for the tit-for-tat dispute. Trump has justified the higher U.S. tariffs as a response to the trade imbalance between the two countries, and China has swiftly responded with higher levies on U.S. imports. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOANews.com. North Korea invites Pope Francis for visit. Wife of ex-Interpol boss held in China describes threat. Officials say Duterte told cabinet he doesn't have cancer. Business booming in Vietnam. Japanese tycoon going on SpaceX rocket says he trusts Musk. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on our Facebook page at VOA Asia, also on our website, that's voanews.com. We continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam on Tuesday declined to explain why the territory has rejected a work visa renewal for Financial Times journalist Victor Mallet, who has been based in Hong Kong for 2 years. Mallet hosted a Foreign Correspondents Club luncheon for independence activist Andy Chan in August. Asked whether the journalist was being punished, Lam would only say that's pure speculation. She insisted freedom of reporting and expression remain core values. But the head of Beijing's Hong Kong and Macau Affairs Office called the event unlawful and aiding separatism. The FCC denied it was in any way endorsing Chan's remarks, but insisted it was a champion of free speech. Mallet's visa expires on Sunday. Felix Patrickeeff, president of the Australian Institute for International Affairs and a Hong Kong analyst, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the decision on Mallet's visa represents what he called a severe blow to what Hong Kong residents were promised under the 1997 Sino-British Joint Declaration, namely a high degree of autonomy, protection of freedom of speech, and association and protest.
All of those are in some ways actually affronted by decision on the part of the Chinese government.
Been a number of reactions from Beijing. China's foreign ministry defended the decision, quote, since the return of Hong Kong under the implementation of one country, two systems, everyone can see Hong Kong's society and economy has achieved a progress. Is this progress?
This certainly isn't, but China's always seen it in rather zero-sum ways, and that is that they would like Hong Kong to make money, which it is, and it's still a very important base for foreign enterprise and for newspapers and media organizations, and for good reason, that there was a great deal of freedom of activity in Hong Kong. But this is really the sharp end of a very large wedge, I think, that is going to make itself more and more felt, because depending on how the world actually reacts to this, China will proceed to use it more and more as a way of actually getting rid of people that it doesn't feel comfortable with in its territory, Hong Kong.
The Global Times newspaper, a state-run publication, said the visa denial had nothing to do with freedom of speech, but that Mallett's actions at the FCC, quote, damaged China's national security and undermined freedom of expression.
Mallett was doing nothing more than exercising a freedom of providing a stage for a political party to actually speak. It's a very small political party, so there is no question of its being able to undermine either the integrity or security of the state. I think it's a way of actually just exerting pressure on the outside influences as China sees it, to make sure that they have full control of what goes on in Hong Kong. The Financial Times, I should add, is a fierce defender of not only freedom of trade, but also freedom of expression, liberal democratic principles. So these are not something that China actually appreciates in any way.
Felix Patrick-Keefe said Hong Kong has enjoyed a varied and vociferous press, and any crackdown on what would represent what he called a blow to all areas of Hong Kong society. The United States, Britain, Canada, and the European Union have expressed their concerns with the territory's American Chamber of Commerce chapter, warning it could damage Hong Kong's competitiveness. Happening now in Asia, China has promised not to weaken its currency to boost exports during a tariff fight with Washington, and rejected U.S. concern about the yuan's sagging exchange rate as groundless and irresponsible. A U.S. official told reporters in Washington the Trump administration is concerned about the weakening yuan. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us, as always, on VOA Asia. For the first time, researchers have been able to track the amount of Chinese investment in Australia. From the purchase of large cattle properties to residential real estate, the scope of Chinese money has led to fraught discussions about the scale of foreign influence in Australia. Phil Mercer in Sydney reports the results of the research may have some surprises for some Australians who have been wary of China's influence and the size of Chinese investments in their country.
The comprehensive new database shows how much Chinese investors are pouring into Australia. Between 2013 and 2017, the figure was more than $28 billion. Most of the money was spent on mining projects and real estate, although increasingly, larger amounts are being invested by the Chinese in tourism in Australia. Academics from the Australian National University say this is proof that Chinese investment is maturing and becoming more sophisticated. Working with business representatives and the Australian government, researchers are, for the first time, charting the real value of Chinese investment. The flow of money from China has been politically sensitive, with concerns that valuable Australian farmland and real estate have become foreign-owned. Professor Peter Drysdale, researcher at the Australian National University, says his work will help to foster a more accurate debate about China's role.
Getting an accurate picture of what's going on is half the battle in having a sensible public discussion, making it possible to have a better informed discussion about what Chinese investment actually does in Australia and what its effect is on the Australian economy.
The database was compiled by painstaking analysis of thousands of transactions from sources such as the Foreign Investment Review Board and the Australian Bureau of Statistics. The research highlighted that Chinese investment in Australia was at its highest in 2016 at $10.5 billion, but dropped to $6.2 billion in 2017. While the report doesn't offer explanations for the sharp fall, bilateral business relations between Beijing and Canberra have been under increasing pressure because of diplomatic friction over alleged Chinese meddling in Australia's domestic politics and the media. Despite the tensions, China remains Australia's most valuable trading partner. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, a cheesy economic trade war develops. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is formally inviting Pope Francis to visit Pyongyang. During their summit in Pyongyang last month, Kim Jong-un told President Moon Jae-in of South Korea his wish for Pope Francis to visit the North. Moon's audience with the Pope will occur during a 9-day tour of Europe. You can stop by and see VOA Asia Facebook any day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, fermenting friction in Japan's cheese trade and prestigious economic prizes are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
Japanese cheesemakers are concerned about a massive EU-Japan trade deal that could bring an influx of new cheeses from Europe to the market. The deal will eliminate the 29.8% tariff currently imposed on imported cheese, increasing competition for local cheesemakers. Kazuhiko Oshii is a local cheese producer.
It's hard for us to lower the price because it takes time and effort for small cheesemakers like us.
The trade deal creates a huge free trade area covering nearly one-third of global GDP and eliminates tariffs for everything from Japanese cars to French cheeses. The government has been quick to respond, as domestic farmers are a key political support group for Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. It has earmarked 15 billion yen in subsidies so far. In the meantime, individual farmers are doing what they can to stay competitive. Kazuhiko Oshii.
Not many Japanese people like cheese with very strong flavors. One way for us to compete is to produce cheese with mild flavors, which more Japanese people would like.
Japanese consumption of cheese has been on the rise for several years, and there is plenty of room for growth. The per capita annual consumption of cheese is close to 3 kilograms in Japan, compared to around 27 kilograms in France and 25 kilograms in Germany. Two American economists, William Nordhaus and Paul Romer, were awarded the 2018 Nobel Prize in Economics this week. Mr. Nordhaus was recognized for developing an economic model that allows economists to consider the costs of climate change. And Mr. Romer was recognized for modeling methods on how market conditions can fuel technological innovations. Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Romer.
I remember promising myself at the time, I'm never going to want to have the Nobel Prize. I'm never going to hope for it. I'm never going to expect it because it can just tear you up. So what do? You face setbacks, you know, you can't get drawn into the rewards. You know, what you do is you commit to something that's larger than yourself. That's what helps you keep going.
Nordhaus and Romer's $1 million award came in the same week the United Nations released a new report in South Korea on climate change. The report says the world can expect serious changes to weather, sea levels, agriculture, and natural ecosystems, even with a modest climate change increase of 1.5 degrees Celsius. The awards were given by the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences and are regarded as one of the most prestigious recognitions for contributions in the field of economics. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia, Malaysia's Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad may introduce new taxes and sell assets such as land to pay down debt as his administration struggles with liabilities of around $240 billion. Malaysia is also looking for revenue to make up the shortfall it's expected to face after scrapping an unpopular goods and services tax. You have access to a wealth of news and features at VOA Asia Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, one of VOA's popular daily features is Science in a Minute. If you're not already familiar with it, we introduce it to you now.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists examined data from NASA's Moon Mineralogy Mapper, or M3 instrument, that was aboard India's Chandrayaan-1 spacecraft to directly observe conclusive proof of water ice on the moon's surface. The team found evidence that the ice was distributed sporadically in the moon's polar regions and could be of ancient origin. Most of the ice at the moon's south pole, found by the scientists, are within lunar craters, while the amount of ice was more widely and thinly spread at the north pole. NASA says that sunlight never reaches the polar regions due to a small tilt of the moon's axis. NASA's M3 instrument, an imaging spectrometer, was able to detect and identify the signatures of three key properties that prove the existence of water ice on the lunar surface. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
In a unique initiative in the tourist city of Shimla in northern India, prisoners are running a popular cafe and a mobile canteen. Anjana Pasricha visited the Himalayan town in the capital of Himachal Pradesh state to find that convicts get a new lease of life as they reconnect with society.
As Jai Chand takes orders from young customers at this popular book cafe on a rainy day in Shimla, his dreams get wings.
I hope I once again get the opportunity to be a part of society. I hope I too will be able to laugh and play with my children.
Chand and his colleague who run the cafe are no ordinary employees. They are convicts serving life terms, who along with others walk out of prison and return there after a day's work, unsupervised, just like other people. Located at a picturesque spot, this cafe is counted as India's boldest experiment in running open prisons. There were questions raised when people learned that life convicts would run the cafe. But the city has accepted them quickly. These school students are among many customers who drop by regularly for the reasonably priced food prepared in a prison bakery. Some pack the food to eat later. Others read. They find the prisoners humble and kind.
I couldn't believe that they ever had committed a crime. I think that they are normal persons and they are just living their life.
Some distance away, three other life convicts are forgetting the claustrophobia of prison as they dole out rice and curry to customers from a van. Planning meals and dealing with customers from the mobile canteen has transformed life for Bhupinder Singh, a murder convict who has spent 18 years in prison.
When I was in jail, only my body was living. I was mentally dead. Since coming here, now along with my body, my mind also works. I meet people. I can dream of a better future. When I am released, I have learned a skill that I can
use.
These ventures have paved the way for allowing more convicts to work outside jail, says Somesh Goyal, Director General of Prisons in Himachal Pradesh. Selected on the basis of their conduct, the first preference goes to prisoners who were the main breadwinners for their families.
They interact with people, they meet family members, they can keep a mobile phone also. So it helps them integrate with the society and feel human. And wherever they go and work, those people also think they are as human or as normal as people outside the prison.
That is what other prisoners aspire for, to venture out of prison during the day and reclaim a place in society. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Shimla, India.
Time for us to venture out. You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud. You'll find us streaming every day on our website at voanews.com. And, of course, you'll want to visit VOA Asia Facebook, both for our program and many great stories and features that you can see and share throughout the day. We'd also like to thank everyone who is listening on the radio. Chiang Mai University, Radio FM 100 at Chiang Mai University in Thailand. Thanks for tuning in today. We also want to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Rob McLean, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. That includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.